Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Asla Bali, who is a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. At Yale Law School, she was the coordinator of the Middle East Legal Forum, and she has an op-ed in Wednesday's New York Times, To Stop the Killing, Deal with Assad. And welcome to Background Briefing, Asla Bali.
Thanks very much.
And apparently the killing has stopped in as much as this ceasefire that began this morning, Thursday, in Syria. So far, there have been no major violations. There's, of course, a great deal of skepticism about it, including skepticism expressed by the head of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, who's, of course, the special delegate, special negotiator, Kofi Annan, the former head of the UN, is the special envoy who's brokered this deal. What's your sense of the deal and how much it's going to hold?
Well, I think that the skepticism about the ceasefire is entirely appropriate because the incentives to maintain a ceasefire are skewed at the moment on both sides. On the one side, the regime has not been cut off from arms suppliers' support by its major backers, Russia and Iran at this point. And as a result, its strategy of maximum repression in an effort to simply eliminate the at least armed elements of the opposition before they can pose a direct threat to the continuity of the regime is likely to continue. On the other hand, what you have is, for the most part, very large unarmed civilian mass demonstrations throughout Syria that are growing by the day. But in addition to that very large movement, you also have a much smaller group or set of groups that are armed resistance forces, and their ranks are also growing every day. And although they too are expected to hold to the ceasefire, they also face a skewed incentive scheme because at the same time that the international community is asking them to commit to a ceasefire, they're also being told by Gulf sponsors, in particular Saudi Arabia and Qatar, that they will be supplied with arms, and by a wider set of actors, including the United States and other countries that attended the Friends of Syria conference in Istanbul, Turkey, that they will be given financial support, logistical support, and communication support. Under those circumstances, of course, the rebels are facing a moral hazard of being encouraged by the international community to resist a negotiated outcome or to resist a ceasefire because they know that they would be able to gain external support. Both sides of that equation, we argue in our op-ed, are problematic insofar as both sides should be incentivized at this point to come to the table to negotiate. A ceasefire is a beginning point from which you can initiate some form of a political solution through negotiations and transition. But that requires that both sides understand that they don't have a violent alternative to that arrangement. And that means bringing Russia and Iran to the table and incentivizing them to communicate to the Assad regime that it's going to get cut off unless it cooperates in the international process. And similarly, on the other side, U.S. and Gulf allies need to communicate the same message to armed groups operating in resistance to the Assad government. Otherwise, you just have a formula for escalating violence on both sides. A ceasefire will hold. It will be tenuous. It will be broken under disputed circumstances, and both sides will continue to experience incentives to resume fighting.
Well, it seems, Asla Bali, that you mentioned in your article in the Wednesday's New York Times, To Stop the Killing, Deal with Assad, the dangers of this becoming a proxy war at the expense of the Syrian people. It may well already be that, given the alignment of the Saudis in the Gulf and the West on one side and the Iranians and, I guess, people like Hugo Chavez on the other. The long and the short of it is a stalemate, isn't it, in the sense that the rebels, even if they're going to be paid by the Saudis and perhaps even armed by the Saudis, they're not going to advance much from the situation they're in now, but they have the capacity for a long, long-term guerrilla war to paralyze that country. And conversely, on the government side, they can't quell all of the rebellion and they can't control all of the country, but they've got Russian arms and enough support. And as I mentioned, Hugo Chavez is providing them with oil and diesel. So this is a genuine stalemate, isn't it? Neither side can win, it would seem.
Yes, in fact, it's a microcosm of the broader stalemate of the competition that's taking place in the region now for spheres of influence, as between Iran and countries that are supporting Iran and view Iran, Syria, et cetera, as their toehold in the region, and countries that support the alternative to that alliance, which is, you know, equally a set of quite immoderate actors, including Saudi Arabia. So you have pitted on two sides, both in the region as a whole and then in the microcosm of Syria, a set of actors, neither of which at this point is in the position to prevail directly. I agree with that. The worst case scenario in Syria is one in which essentially the country gets cut off, increasingly isolated, and while that isolation is taking place, which is essentially cutting off also the civilian population from a variety of kinds of support they might seek, you have arms flowing into the country on both sides at a rather rapid clip, which will simply fuel and escalate the existing violence. We saw something like this happen in Bosnia in the 1990s, when technically there was an arms embargo, but in fact, both on the side of the Serbs and on the side of the Bosnian Muslims, both sides were getting supply and rearmament, and essentially what happened is that the conflict and the fighting escalated and escalated. That is not obviously a workable solution. At the end of the day, the way in which the Bosnia crisis was concluded was at the negotiating table through a political solution, and however less than perfect that solution at Dayton might have been, it was certainly an improvement over the level of killing that we saw in Bosnia. Syria has not reached that point yet. In 14 months, something on the order of 10,000 people being killed is disastrously heavy toll, but not comparable to what we might see if you had a really full civil war. So I think we need to really keep a focus on the cost that is going to be imposed. And that begins with the civilian population in Syria. I agree entirely that they are, in fact, the ones that are paying the price for this, what appears to be shaping up as a proxy war. But it may not just be restricted to the Syrian civilian population, because to the extent that this takes on very clearly sectarian hues, and it appears to be doing so with not just Saudi and Qatar, but also Turkey playing a sectarian role, Sunni actors in Iraq playing a sectarian role, and on the other side, Shi'i community in both Iraq and Lebanon, and of course Iran and so forth, this has the possibility of destabilizing what are already quite fragile balances of sectarian interest in neighboring countries, namely Lebanon and Iraq. And if we saw a return to full-fledged sectarian conflict in Iraq, or a return to the same in Lebanon, the numbers of civilians that would now be endangered would be multiplied manyfold. So the risks associated with not finding a political solution at this point are extremely high, and as a result, it's a very serious moment for the international community to confront that there is, that really what we've produced is an extremely negative set of incentive schemes for both sides in this conflict. And if we want to de-escalate the violence, it means a coordinated effort. Now, one thing that's worth pointing out is, to the extent that this is a regional proxy war, it's basically over the stakes of the sort of fate of Iran as a regional player. Iran has its backers who view Iran as their position of strength in the Middle East, and of course it has its opponents, ranging from other Gulf Arab states to Israel. And, of course, the already tense relationship between Iran and the United States. But I think it's worth noting that to the extent that the Syrian conflict is really a proxy for or an extension of a broader regional conflict around Iran, one has to really look at the stakes in this conflict seriously and what needs to be brought to the table to be negotiated. Particularly, what I mean by this is Iran and Russia have no reason to put genuine pressure on their ally in Syria at this point, if that means simply losing an aspect of their own sphere of influence in the region at their expense, coming up with a political solution that consolidates the position of their adversaries regionally. No set of parties are likely to sign up for that kind of a geostrategic calculation. Instead, in order to get the Russians and the Iranians to be prepared to make a concession on their sphere of influence in the region, one has to offer something in return that's worth negotiating over from their perspective. And that means opening up the file and becoming much more serious about a negotiated track around the Iran problem, which is, of course, the nuclear file, but also the questions of Iran's security concerns, Israeli dimension, and so forth. Those are elements that are central, basically, to resolving what's happening in Syria today, because unless they're confronted as a really relevant dimension of what lies behind the escalation of conflict in Syria, any political solution is going to be unlikely to hold.
Again, I'm speaking with Asla Bali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. At Yale Law School, she was a coordinator of the Middle East Legal Forum and had an op-ed in Wednesday's New York Times to stop the killing deal with Assad. So you were saying that both sides are locked in situations with negative incentives. What possible positive incentives could be brought to the table?
So, I mean, if we, and by we, I mean the international community, the West, powers that wish to see a resolution in Syria that involves regime transition, but hopefully one that's negotiated as opposed to a forcible overthrow, which will likely yield civil war conditions in Syria. So a negotiated transition that sees the departure of Assad under, you know, some agreed political scheme. Those who support that outcome need to understand that in order to get Russia and Iran to support that outcome, we're asking them to give up one of their allies, a regime that's in an alliance with them, and that will very likely be replaced by another set of actors that are more palatable both to the domestic population that has risen up against this regime and to powers in the region that feel that the Syrians represent an adversary, by which I mean the Gulf Arab countries, Israel, the United States, and so forth. So if we're going to end up with a regime more friendly to those powers and less friendly to Russia and Iran, and we want Russia and Iran to sign up for that deal, we're going to have to understand that that means bringing something to the table that's desirable for Russia and Iran. You know, so for example, in the Russian case, an example would be an assured access to the warm water Mediterranean port of Tartus, which is currently a place where Russia stations its a fleet of its, because it doesn't have direct access to the Mediterranean from the Black Sea without having to travel through the Turkish Straits. On the Iranian side, obviously, we are now at a point where we have tightened sanctions to the maximum level with respect to Iran over the nuclear program, but have initiated only, at best, half-hearted steps towards negotiation against the backdrop of a systematic drumbeat of war and military threats to engage in a unilateral attack against Iranian facilities. Lowering the temperature on that set of confrontations over the Iranian nuclear file, reinitiating meaningful negotiating tracks, political engagement, and so forth with Iran would give Iran a reason to feel less insecure and more able to, you know, cooperate with the international community on one side, where it's in fact being engaged cooperatively on the other side. So I think it means getting serious about putting the Iranian question centrally on the table and offering the Iranians a meaningful negotiating framework. Short of that, I really can't see how Russia and Iran are going to have the incentive to join an international strategy that involves the exit of their ally. And if they don't, then that ally is going to carry on being supplied with the means to continue the conflict. And that's a catastrophe for lots of reasons. The Syrian civilian population is my principal concern, but from the U.S. perspective, just strategically and in terms of national security, the potential to destabilize very serious interests that the United States has in Turkey, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Jordan, and in Israel also looms over this conflict. And so it's not simply that Syrian civilians are to be sacrificed for us, meaning the international community as a whole, playing out their proxy conflicts. It's not just a question of the Syrian civilian population. That, to my mind, is the most important priority, protecting that vulnerable population, which is now caught in crossfire between two sets of forces that have resorted to arms. But
there's no symmetry between the. Sorry to interrupt you, but there's no symmetry between the armed sides.
I mean, no, of course, there's no symmetry between the armed sides. That's absolutely true. Just as in Iraq, there was no symmetry between, you know, the amassing of very serious military forces under the coalition and an insurgency. But the capacity of insurgents to wreak havoc on civilian populations was very high. So I'm not suggesting in any way that the battle is somehow even between Assad's forces and the insurgents. The insurgents, the armed resistance, is at a very great disadvantage. But parties that are at a very great disadvantage in that way also have the possibility of relying on asymmetric tactics, often at the expense of civilian populations.
Sure. So, Asla Bali, why then, if this is the only way that there has to be a compromise, certainly the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been quite forthright in her skepticism, saying that, first of all, she said that today that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad would have to go, and she said the Annan plan is not a menu of options, it's a set of obligations. So that's been going on for some time. The U.S. has been saying he has to go, he will go. They've been saying saying that. There's no indications that he is. You're suggesting, I think by implication, that any kind of deal would have to include some kind of government, a coalition government that includes Assad. The indications from the U.S. are that that's a non-starter.
I wouldn't say that it includes Assad. I think it's basically unfortunate that the U.S. has taken that position, not because I think Bashar al-Assad should remain, but rather because it creates a no-exit scenario in which it basically incentivizes the regime to dig in because they're being told that any outcome is going to involve their elimination as a regime, and that's not a helpful way to engage in negotiation, as we've seen in multiple other contexts. A blueprint for the kind of political solution, negotiated transition, would be what happened in Yemen, which, again, is suboptimal, certainly. The best-case scenario for Yemen would have been elimination of the Saleh regime as a whole, not just the removal of Saleh himself, but also the removal of his deputies and others who have been implicated in the kind of corrupt autocratic rule that he has been associated with. That's not what happened in Yemen. What happened in Yemen instead is, in exchange for ending the violence on the part of the government, Saleh was compelled to step down by his regional allies, and his deputy took over in a transitional context as Yemen then moves in the direction of a new electoral strategy. That's suboptimal. A better outcome would have been immediately turning to new elections and replacing all of these regime figures. The same thing could be said of Egypt, where now we're talking about Omar Suleiman potentially being considered as a presidential candidate, which would represent the return of the Mubarak regime rather than transition. But these are scenarios that have been contemplated elsewhere, largely to avoid the levels of violence and instability that we now see in Syria. That's the kind of model. Now, in Yemen, it was possible because the allies of Saleh in Yemen, we were in fact on that side, and we ourselves had an incentive to see Saleh transition in a way that retained some continuity with that regime and with our joint interest with them, particularly related to the war on terror, but also the Gulf Cooperation Council's interests and so forth. In this instance, we're on the other side, and we imagine that we have something to gain from the rapid and immediate exit of Assad, and as a result, we've taken much more the stance that was taken towards Gaddafi, must go, has to go, held accountable, and so forth. None of these things are likely to produce a negotiated political solution, and that should be the priority. In other words, prioritizing peace at this moment first, an end to the violence because of humanitarian considerations, and then turning to questions of what kind of mechanisms of accountability might we have in place for a Saleh, for a Mubarak, for a Ben Ali. Those kinds of questions come second. Unfortunately, when they don't, when we prioritize that and we insist on sending a message to the regime that it has no exit option at all, then what we see is what happened in Libya, which is a rapid escalation of the conflict and then ultimately a collapse of institutions, which, of course, I mean, is also a suboptimal outcome.
Well, it's even worse with Syria, that scenario, because they have vast chemical and biological arsenals. So you could end up with a Somalia on the Mediterranean. But just in closing, Asla Bali, Turkey is obviously playing a major role here, having hosted the Friends of Syria conference. Turkish leader, Prime Minister Erdogan, was in Tehran just, a week ago, where he met with the Supreme Leader, apparently, assuming he was laying the groundwork for this meeting that's taking place over the weekend in Turkey involving the P5, the permanent five heads of the UN Security Council, plus Germany and Iran. My assumption is that some of the stuff that you're talking about that needs to be done in terms of incentivizing both the Russians and the Iranians, it sounds like the Turkish leader who's brokering these talks has already discussed this stuff, surely.
I hope that's right. I mean, obviously, this would be behind the scenes. That wasn't officially what was discussed very much. The same can be said of today's meeting between Clinton and Lavrov. Again, one hopes that the discussion behind the scenes was one that addressed Russian concerns and, in the case of Iran, Iranian concerns, and that put Syria front and center and not just the, other ancillary questions associated with the P5+1 or EU3+3 negotiations with Iran. So I hope you're right. Having said that, Turkey has also made some other kinds of alarming moves in the last week, including speaking much more seriously about the safe zones or humanitarian corridor idea, which, to be clear, is an idea of having foreign troops, either Turkish or other, on Syrian soil, maintaining a particular area outside of the Syrian regime's control in order to protect civilians in that area. Going down that route of humanitarian corridors, I mean, essentially we have a safe zone and humanitarian corridor now. It's just on the Turkish side of the border. But when we talk about placing it on the Syrian side of the border, what we're discussing is something that, you know, very likely would be understood to be a serious escalation of the conflict.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Asla Bali.
Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Asla Bali. She's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. She had an op-ed in Wednesday's New York Times, "To Stop the Killing, Deal with Assad." This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.